Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Welcome back to the Bunker Daily with me, Andrew Harrison. We hope you'll be joining us for the exclusive Zoom live stream next Thursday, the 9th of July at 8 o'clock. It's exclusive to Patreon backers, so search Patreon Bunker Podcast to sign up and join us for drinks and diatribes. Today on the Bunker, when's the last time you ate out? Can you remember the last restaurant you visited and what you had? And how much would you give to have a meal that you don't have to cook yourself and dishes that you don't have to do afterwards? COVID has been an existential shock for the restaurant business, and now the industry, worth $38 billion, with more than 86,000 restaurants up and running before the crisis, faces a fight for survival. And almost a million people who work in the restaurant business could lose their jobs too. What are restaurants doing to save themselves? What does government need to do? And how can we help, apart from ordering 10 gourmet burgers a night? To explain all this, we're joined by the doyen of restaurant critics, host of Radio 4's Kitchen Cabinet, author of a string of books, including A Greedy Man in a Hungry World and Wasted Calories and Ruined Nights, host of the Out to Lunch podcast. I knew him when he was my editor at the Leeds Student newspaper. It's Jay Rayner. How are you doing?
It's very nice to see how well you've come on in life, Andrew.
Oh, well, I've done my best. You know, I've tried to follow your example, Jay, in a small way.
And fulfill the faith I had in you when you were my, I think you were my deputy at one point, weren't you?
I was your mini me.
Yeah.
I was your junior.
Yeah. That's, I can't remember what the age difference is. I think you're actually older than me.
I'm older than everybody these days, which it certainly feels that way. So, listen, I want to ask you.
Yeah.
You must be climbing the walls. Your raison d'etre has been robbed from you.
Well, no, it hasn't. And I'm very, very sort of insistent that people understand that I've not had a bad pandemic. and that is because my job is a writing job, not an eating job. I mean, let's be absolutely clear. I love restaurants. I adore them. I am gagging to get back into them. I have two bookings on July the 4th, not just one. One at lunch, one at dinner. It wasn't planned, but it's happened. But my job is a writing job, and I have been fully employed through this. I'm very, you know, I've checked my privilege. I've got loads. But yes, I want to get back into them. Not because... really, I had nothing to write about. I've had loads to write about. But because I think what we all crave is normality. We are desperate to get back to some form of normality. The big shock, I'm afraid, is that we'll go through a week to 10 days of, woohoo, we're back in. And then it will start to dawn on us that, no, we're not really. We're not quite. It's not like it was. It's very different.
Yeah. So we are recording this on the 30th of June.
Yeah,
and the unlocking's happening on the 4th of July this weekend. Apart from yourself, who's obviously going to like fly in like crazy, but where are your bookings then? Where are you going? What are your first places?
I can't entirely tell you. So first of all, there was a place in the city, the Square Mile. They dropped an email into my inbox. I'm sure it was just a general mailing. I was just one on a big list saying we're taking bookings, but that was very early. I would say the first week of June. And when I first saw it, I closed my inbox down and went, hang on, what? And I thought the least I could do is reward this ridiculous act of stupid self-confidence on their part by booking a table. So I booked one that evening for, it's a late one, it's 9 o'clock, which is helpful as it turns out. So that will be the first review, but because of newspaper lead times, which you fully understand, won't appear until July the 19th. Now, at that point, we all realised at the paper that, hey, these restaurants are opening on a Saturday. The Observer is a Sunday paper. It's one of the curios of a Sunday paper that we look back over the whole week, but we are also the daily paper of the day that's just gone before, the Saturday. So we need to have a piece from me, a colour piece in the news pages saying, woohoo, restaurants are back open and here is our restaurant critic at the table. So then I have I had to book another table. It's a smaller restaurant with a good profile, but it's more of a neighbourhood place than anything else.
So listeners, if they have a copy of The Observer with them and they tap you on the shoulder, they win £5. They can. Where in the world
that
is
was always Rainer? Your thing, wasn't it? It was always if you spot me. That must have been a really big thing on Merseyside in the newspaper business. That spot our man. Did the Liverpool Echo do this?
They almost certainly did. The Meat Traders Journal might have done it. I don't know. So are you expecting a good result for the restaurant industry over the slightly longer term? Because, as you say, there's going to be 10 days of binging, but there's structural problems.
It's going to be extremely tough.
Yeah.
Extremely tough. Because, you know, when it was, I wrote a news story for The Observer about, you know, the impossibility of reopening under 2 meters social distancing because the economics simply didn't work. You'd have to pull out over 50% of the tables. And although every week, every Sunday in the comments below the line on my restaurant review, people whinge about price, the restaurant industry isn't a gold mine. It's a financial conveyor belt. They need money going in one end and coming out the other. And that's how it works. And if that conveyor belt stops, which is what's happened, even the most seemingly successful restaurants are in trouble. So they've all had a very, very hard time. And the one thing that's going to be in their favor is the next couple of months. In Britain's big cities, certainly in Westminster, there are plans to open up huge numbers of streets to turn them into a big open-air cafe along the model of the Vilnius plan, the big summer cafe. So if you've got a combination of outside eating and takeaways and the number that you can get inside, I think certain restaurants will be able to get themselves towards a form of profitability, but they've had their resources depleted. It's very, very tough. And then there are other questions. One, a lot of people don't have a lot of cash at the end of this. They've been furloughed, they've been out of work or whatever. And two, for all of those of us who are gagging to get out into a crowd and think, looking at the metrics, that it's okay, there are a lot of people who quite reasonably just don't want to get in a crowd. And one of the things that was said to me very early on in this by a very good restaurateur, Russell Norman, he said, you know, we're selling an atmosphere. We're selling a room. We're not selling plates of food. We're selling a good night out. And you have to look in the room and want to go in there. And I hope that people feel comfortable and safe enough to do so. But that's going to make it very tricky. I wish I could be just much more optimistic. I'm delighted so many are back. But there are real challenges ahead.
Yeah, I mean, we sort of started on the podcast talking about FOGO in a semi kind of humorous way, fear of going out, but it's actually real.
Oh, it's absolutely real. I mean, you know, various people are going to be in high risk categories. We know what the infection rate is around central London for the moment, but on the day that we're talking, all the Leicester stuff has really kicked off.
Yeah.
And there's no particular reason why Leicester should be unique. In fact, we've already been told it won't be. And at some point, there will be other outbreaks. And this is a bastard of a virus, and it kills people. So, you know, it's not ridiculous to have concerns. But I suppose if you do all the things you can do, then you should be able to return to some form of normality. Because epidemics do come in peaks and troughs.
Yeah. You know, without wanting to sort of, you know, I'm just trying to be glass half full with this.
Oh, yeah.
Are there parts of the restaurant business that were... You know, we all talk in terms of disruption. Oh, disrupting an industry is always great. Other parts of the restaurant business that you'll be glad to see, you know, fade away. You know, nasty practices, places that just were not doing what people need.
All right. So here are the things that appear to be suffering. There are some very high end restaurants that we've heard about closures of. The Greenhouse in Mayfair has gone, a Michelin 2-star. I do not believe the number. I mean, obviously, I don't want anybody to lose their jobs, but we can afford to lose a few Michelin 2-star restaurants, 3-star, all that sort of stuff. That's not going to make a massive dent in the culture. Let's put it that way. I suspect some of the mega chains are really going to suffer because a lot of their trade is city centre based. And one of the things the restaurant business is really talking about at the moment is that the suburbs or the inner suburbs are doing fine because people don't necessarily want to travel that far. But the centre of cities, the centre of London, is a bit of a wasteland. So we may see some big chains being brought low by moderate trade in their outer central restaurants, but nothing at all in the center of town. And actually, again, just today, on the day that we're talking, June 30th, a group of major London restaurateurs led by Angela Hartnett and Trevor Gulliver, who's Fergus Henderson's business partner at St. John, have put together a letter sort of basically saying, don't let London die, don't overlook us, with a whole bunch of claims, which I know some people have reacted quite badly to. It's like, put more carriages on tube trains. I'm not sure where they'll come from. Scrap the congestion charge. Well, I don't think TfL is really, Transport for London is really in a position to do that. But that's one of the things we're seeing. Central London is potentially in real trouble.
Do you think that there'll be a change in people's, you know, what people are looking for from restaurants, not just in the sense that we might have to get used to, you know, the very expensive bill and so on, but might we sort of see the industry retrenching into kind of maybe more conventional menus that you visit, for places you visit more often, rather than the kind of outre mad places you visit once a year?
Let's start with the basics here, which is what we've just gone through is, you know, we call it once in a lifetime. It's not, it's once in a century event, like a world war. And they change society. They change things drastically. And I think there are going to be some massive changes. I'm not going to try and be Nostradamus and claim I know what they are. But there's going to be a lot of disruption and a lot of change. One would hope it would take the froth off the top of it. The silliness, the stuff which is all style over substance. But I've been railing against that for the stupidly long number of years that I've been doing this job. The cost of eating out is likely to go up rather than down, to be honest. For example, you know, just on simple social distancing measures, things like, you know, if you decide various people in the kitchen all have to wear gloves, or you've got masks, you've got sanitizers, you've got disposable menus, a business can easily run up £100 a day on that. That's £25,000 a year before you know where you're at. And that has to be recouped somehow. So I think we're going to see extra costs. And it will be very interesting to see what happens to those luxe restaurants supported by a high net worth economy, which floats above the rest of, you know, the rest of society, but which has sustained a whole bunch of businesses for a very long time, which we could probably do without.
It's interesting you mentioned that, you know, things like a world war, because, you know, the last world war gave us the Lion's Corner houses, didn't it? And the kind of eating, the kind of large communal eating places where it was a good, cheap meal. But of course, it was a lot of people in a small space. Well, you know, that's not going to happen again. But you wonder if another kind of epiphenomenon might happen where we just eat out differently. And for example, my wife's American and she does not understand why we don't have a diner culture here where you might eat out once or twice a week. Could something like that happen? I don't know.
I love the fact that Lily, after so many years in this country, still doesn't understand certain things. I mean, it's what, 30 years? Still doesn't understand. We were already seeing some very interesting things happening. The way that street food culture had mutated in both interesting ways and disturbing ways, but created an entry point for younger cooks of colour, who couldn't access the hospitality industry through any other way, using it as an access point by which to create something more permanent, cheaper, that people of a younger generation who frankly couldn't afford the ridiculous bills in most restaurants, that happening. And I think more of that would be a very, very good thing.
It's interesting you say that bills might go up, because I did one of these dailies the other day about the live music business.
Oh, yeah.
Which faces a lot of very similar things.
Well, you know, I can talk about
and
that.
You're
as well.
In it. Yeah. Well, in your capacity as Jay Rayner, jazz pianist. There we go. Yeah. But what the person I was talking to was saying gigs are going to get cheaper because they're going to need to get cheaper, because you're looking at a different market. You're looking at young people who will have even less money, who have a different attitude to the danger of the virus, and they just will need to get them through the door.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose I should say, as a jazz pianist, tickets have never been expensive because nobody will ever pay a lot of money for jazz. But, you know, we're going to have limits on audience sizes. Also, actually, there's not been a lot of talk about this. Limits on number of performers on stage. I front the Jay Rayner Quartet. We're not entirely sure whether we can get four people on the stage socially distanced. Ronnie Scott's opens quite shortly, and I've just heard that they may be thinking about no more than two people on stage at once. It's kind of interesting.
So you're going to be the Jay Rayner duo.
Well, I can do that because the singer's, you know, seeing as my wife. So
yeah, you can't fire her, can you?
I can't fire her, but also I think we're better on social distancing, given that we often share the same bed. Well, I say often, all the time.
Too much information, Jay.
I sleep in the same bed as my wife.
So
yeah,
talking about the kind of the value of the restaurant business to the economy, it is a huge business, and actually it falls on some of the most precariously employed and underpaid people as well.
Yes, it does.
This has got huge social consequences.
Yeah, the you gave some figures at the top. The ones I've always banded, I banded them around for the hospitality industry, which I think includes hotels and bars and everything, is somewhere north of 75 billion. And a workforce altogether of over 3 million. And there is concern that 1 million of those could lose their jobs just like that. And then we are back very quickly in the unemployment rates of the 1980s. But you're absolutely right. A lot of these jobs are underpaid, and the working standards are just not very good. And a crisis is not necessarily the best way to see improvements in living standards, is it? And that's concerning. So you're, in a way, you've got a catch-22. You want people to go out. You want people to spend their money in restaurants and bars. But you're also telling them that it may cost more if you want the people who are serving you to receive the kind of remuneration they deserve. I might have been saying that for a while, but people get very cross.
It's actually quite similar to the music business as well, in the world where, you know, music's been effectively free for, you know, 20 years, and the argument that you've got to pay for this if you want it to exist, still, you know, it's quite hard to get across to people. Well,
it is. I mean, we've seen a change in the music industry, which I know from lots of my more professional friends, which is that the recorded music is of very little value, and you now do that for a promotion for the live. And live is now, in a digital age where it's hard to really have an authentic experience, the live experience becomes the thing. But this does apply to restaurants as well. It's about getting close to something that feels uniquely, authentically real. And that's one of the great things about restaurants. It's someone cooking for you in real time.
Yeah. So what can be done about all this? I want to ask you firstly about what is government doing and ought to be doing in order to preserve this sector, which is a huge part of the culture, but also a huge part of the hard economy.
Yeah, well, I don't think it just applies to the hospitality sector, this, but there are various parts of the economy which need a fully tapered long-term furlough scheme, where you have to acknowledge that you cannot get everybody back to work at the same rate. And, you know, there are some businesses that will all be going back, a lot of non-essential retail that are already back, but restaurants will have to ease their way back. We all know, I'm crossing my fingers at you, that the thing we're hoping for is a vaccine, but even then, how long would that take to vaccinate our population of over 60 million? We're talking a year, 2 years. This is a long, drawn-out experience. So a longer furloughing scheme, and this is... This is why I put my old political history head on, as we did a similar degree at university back in the century before this
one. The good old days.
People, you know, fret about, well, where is all this money coming from? How can this be? And there are these once in a century moments where what, as a government, you do is you say it's almost like taking out a mortgage on a house. Rack up a discrete package of enormous debt, which you then pay off. One of the guests on my fine podcast, Out to Lunch, other podcasts are available, was Ed Balls, the former Chief Secretary to the Treasury. He told me that during his time as Chief Secretary to the Treasury, they paid off the last tranche of money of the loans that they'd raised for the Second World War. That is what we're talking about, a 50-year, 60-year payoff for this kind of debt. So you put it to one side, you pay it off like a mortgage while maintaining the economy. So we need to see an extended furlough system. I think the end of VAT on hot food would be a really good idea. So at the moment, I don't know if you're across the VAT system, but VAT is payable on hot food, which means while certain, you know, the vast majority of food in supermarkets is non-VATable, food in restaurants is VATable. The theory being that value has been added through the preparation thereof. If they removed VAT from restaurant food, prices could, well, in theory, drop by 20%, but just imagine they were able to keep 5% of that.
Yeah.
And then you've got an economic model, but they become cheaper to the consumer. It's things like that.
Yeah. Which eventually returns to the exchequer anyway in the form of increased spending people can keep their jobs. Yeah,
round and round and round it goes. The logic of the whole furlough system was that if they let everybody fall out of work, the welfare bill and the impact on communities and the impact on education, the impact on skills would just be vast. So it wasn't some, generous, let's look after people idea. It simply made economic sense.
Yeah. And I'd sort of mentioned at the beginning the idea that there must be something we can do apart from ordering 10 gourmet burgers a night. And I've got to admit, I've been feeling good about ordering in. I've been feeling I'm supporting businesses here. There's got to be something more that, we the people can do apart from, forcing ourselves to go out more.
Well, if I was being really kind of fist in the air and brutal about it, I would say choose where you spend that money. There are a lot of big chains, perhaps owned by hedge funds. You might decide that it is better to spend your money with independents where that is going back into the economy directly rather than hit the bottom line of some investment fund. I think it's about consumers making choices,
which is easier to do if you're like us and you live in London and you live in places with lots of independent restaurants. And it may be one of the reasons that you moved to live here anyway. But if you're kind of elsewhere in the country,
that's absolutely true. Although the picture across the country is very different from what it was just over the I caused a bit of a stir 48 hours ago when I tweeted that for the foreseeable future, there would be no negative restaurant reviews from me. Doesn't mean that I'll give everywhere a good review. I'll be talking about this in more detail in my column. But, people got a bit sort of up to go, well, what's the point of you? I was just saying, if I come across a place that's not very good, I just won't write about it. I only write 50 restaurant reviews a year, and there are lots of terrible places I never write about. I'm just going to write about fewer terrible restaurants. But then I also, one of the interesting things is London restaurants are very good at letting you know what's going on. They have PRs to help them. And I suspect a lot of the PRs are doing stuff for free for the moment to, get their clients through. So they've all told me when they're opening. But what I didn't have was a picture of what's going on across the UK. So I just put out a tweet saying, restaurants outside London, let me know when you're reopening. I kid you not, on this computer over here, on my email, it could be the computer in front of me, I have, dozens, well over 100 emails from independent little restaurants all over the UK announcing what they're doing. And it's heartening, actually. It's a story of, we talk about the hospitality industry, which makes it sound like mining or steelworking. But in reality, it's a cottage industry of individuals who just want to run restaurants. And whatever it was like 20 years ago when I, God help me, first started this job, it's a very different landscape now. And there are very few places in the UK where your choices really are those highly sophisticated but rather monotonous chains. Everywhere now has its independence. Maybe you just need to do a little bit more research, or maybe people like me need to do their work and tell you where they are.
You have been writing a lot in the – you wrote at the weekend, actually, about restaurants that have been innovating with meal kits, the takeaways that you cook yourself.
It was one of a trio. I've got three of those in a row. Mm-hmm. I kind of – it's interesting. Right at the beginning, I was late transferring in real time. So the restaurants closed, but I still had 2 or 3 weeks restaurant reviews that ran. And by the same token, the restaurants will start reopening, but I'll still be talking about delivery meal kits for a couple of weeks, which is fine because I think that's still going to be a part of the story. And there has been a lot of really good innovation, and some of that will remain. So the one at the weekend, I think Jaconi, Ravinder Bogle's place, she'd innovated brilliantly. They'd done a lot of work on coming up with compostable packaging, which kind of matters.
Yeah.
You don't want to feel like an eco scumbag when you get your takeaway in. And then I've got one coming up this weekend. It's actually from a group of restaurants in the Northwest, where you're from. Where you're from. And they're sending out full meal kits, which are hilarious because they're basically take bag A and put into a pot of water and then plate with bag B and bag C. And it's all recyclable plastic, but it's very, very complicated. I can't tell you the mess I made in my own kitchen.
One of the ironies of your column is that there's almost somebody in the comments going, 60 quid for that, I could cook it at home. And now we are cooking it at home. Well, it is actually happening. But has this changed our relationship with cooking? Not just the sourdough craze and not just the fact that, you know, there's a certain sort of Marie Antoinette-ish kind of, oh, I cooked it for some people.
Yeah, there was one chef who said to me, I'm really worried that people will have a different relationship with restaurants that have worked out they can do it themselves. Well, we have actually, it's been a very binary story, the story of food during COVID-19. It's been a story between people being able to luxuriate in food because they got the money to afford it and they can, and they're actually enjoying cooking, or even if they're moaning about it, oh God, another night, whatever. And then those who've had no food at all. And that's been the utter dichotomy. But no, I maybe some people will have discovered a new joy in time in the kitchen. I've had a lot of fun, but then, you know, that's what I do. But a lot of people will be gagging to get back to the old normal, not a new normal. And that means that they will, if they can, want to go to restaurants.
Finally, this is all taking place against the backdrop of an impending, probable no-deal Brexit. And you gave us a, hey, Brexit bingo. You gave us a pretty chilling idea of what old-fashioned Brexit might mean for food on a Pastromaniacs. This could be serious injury on top of serious injury.
You know, I wrote a big piece about what happened to the food supply chain during COVID for The Observer, still available online. You can find a link to it on my website, jrayner.co.uk. And one of the people I spoke to said, a very serious food analyst, he said, we're expecting 25% of traded global food to simply fall out, that there's a long-term thing, that we've got through it for now, but now we're trying to get back on, you know, but it's going to be rocky in the months to come. One of the real issues is that any kind of store that there was that had been put in place to deal with that no-deal Brexit possibility in January has gone. And now we are, what can I tell you? It's still the same stuff. We're talking about flows through ports. We're talking about workforce. It's all very, very bleak. And, the gang in Downing Street carries on doing their bellicose chat about we're out, there's no transition. I'm beginning to suspect they're going to find a weasel way with language to extend. Something to do with, we'll just maintain a customs union. And the EU will agree to it for lots of reasons. But otherwise, it's very serious, this. It's very serious indeed. And as you say, we've been preoccupied and we may not see it coming.
You know, we've been suspecting on the podcast that, you know, and it's not the world's most piercing insights, that, you know, like the way you give a dog a pill by wrapping it in bacon, that this, you know, this kind of catastrophe may be the thing that, you know, no deal is wrapped up in. But I guess we're going to find out pretty soon, aren't we?
I think we are. There will be a literal and figurative hunger for reassurance that the whole system is not going to fall apart. One small observation, I've always been struck by the fact that Dominic Cummings presents himself as a technocrat, not an ideologue, just someone who wants things to function better. And now he's in charge, and they've made a bloody mess of it, technocratically. Yes. And it looks to me like the same is about to happen over Brexit. We'll see. They're going to have to own it.
Well, all we can do in the meantime, you and I, is to try and, in the wise words of Mark E. Smith, eat yourself fitter, eat our way out of this, go out, buy things and eat them. Jay Rayner, thank you very much for joining us. And do come back soon if you can face it. Remember, listeners, there's a new Bunker Daily on Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays and Fridays. The main panel podcast comes out on Wednesdays. Don't forget the live stream is on Thursday, the 9th of July at 8 p.m. So go to Patreon Bunker to find out about that. Thank you for listening and we will see you soon. The Bunker Daily was presented and produced by me, Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Jacob Archbold, and audio production is by Robin Leeburn. The Bunker Daily is a Podmasters production.